The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And this is something, as your question indicated, the United States has been doing since 9/11. It's been trying to go after not just the bin Ladens, not just the people who plant bombs, but the senior recruiters, the senior trainers, the senior planners. And these are the people that gave Al-Qaeda its depth, that made it such a dangerous organization. And I think one of the reasons that Al-Qaeda has been far less effective in global operations, far less effective attacks on the U.S. and attacks on Europe, is because people like al-Masri have been killed or otherwise taken out of the game. And so this is part of the U.S. strategy, is to go after a fairly broad swath of these people. And it's been fairly effective in the relatively narrow terms we're talking about for counterterrorism.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 17th, 2020. The world's most dangerous job apparently has a vacancy once again. Al-Qaeda's number two has reportedly been killed in Iran by Israeli forces acting on U.S. intelligence. In addition, there are some rumors about Al-Qaeda's number one, Ayman al-Zawahiri, also passing into the hereafter. These are sketchy, but we're going to talk about it. Joining us in the virtual jungle studio is Lawfare's foreign policy editor, Brookings scholar, and Georgetown professor Daniel Byman, counterterrorism expert extraordinaire and Al-Qaeda watcher. We're going to go over the reports, the gossip, and the rumors. Stand by. It's going to be fun. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 17th. Job openings in Al-Qaeda. All right, Dan. First of all, I want to start by noting that when we turn to Al-Qaeda as a respite from the news, you know something's wrong.
It is remarkable to actually have a smile on your face when you're reading news about Al-Qaeda and then when you're reading about the United States to get horribly depressed, but that is the mental space I'm in right now.
I mean, you know, this feels like Lawfare comfort food. We're talking about operations, covert operations in the Middle East that have killed Al-Qaeda senior management. So let's start with what we know. Who is the gentleman who was killed in Iran, and what do we know about the operation?
So the report is that Abu Muhammad al-Masri has been killed, and he is someone who goes way back. He joined the anti-Soviet Afghan Jihad in the 1980s. He was a founding member of Al-Qaeda when it was a tiny organization. He went with the organization into Sudan when the organization spent several years in exile there, and he was part of the Leadership Council. He managed operations in Africa. He managed training. Because he managed operations in Africa, he is held responsible for the 1998 embassy bombings. And so he's someone who historically was an incredibly important figure. After Al-Qaeda was rousted from Afghanistan after 9/11, he fled to Iran. And the belief is he's been there ever since. And so there are questions, or at least I have questions,
about how active an operational role he's been playing in recent years. But having said all that, he historically was a very important figure and important in terms also of killing Americans, not just Al-Qaeda. It seems as if he was killed by a hit team directed by Israel. The New York Times had a good and quite detailed report on this that was operating from a motorcycle. They drove by when he was in a car and fired several shots and killed him. And that this was done at the behest of the United States. I don't have any of my own information to corroborate this, but it certainly seems possible given that Israel has shown a remarkable ability to operate in Iran and did a similar campaign against, or we think they did a similar campaign against Iranian nuclear scientists, and that this is an individual the United States has wanted to go after for quite some time, but the U.S. has been hesitant to go operate in Iran directly. So this all makes sense, but again, how much information is available beyond the New York Times is unclear to me.
One aspect of it that doesn't make sense to me is the idea of the Israelis operating at the U.S. behest in Iran against what is really more of a U.S. target than an Israeli target. So the Israelis have, to my knowledge, operated against Al-Qaeda in, to some degree, southern Syria, when it's appropriate, when, you know, when it's convenient for them to do so. But they have not been a big part of the anti-Al-Qaeda coalition per se, and in fact, at times have, you know, cooperated with elements of the Syrian resistance that are probably Al-Qaeda linked. And when they have operated in Iran, which they have quite aggressively, it's generally been about their own nuclear targets, the Iranian nuclear program, which they are very serious about. And it's also been directed at Hezbollah-related targets. Can you think of any precedent for basically the Israelis carrying out what's essentially a U.S. operation?
So there are a couple things to add to your points. One is that because Abu Muhammad al-Masri was heading Africa operations, he was probably responsible for the 2002 attacks in Kenya that killed 13 Kenyans, but also three Israeli tourists. So there has been a link to Israel with this particular guy, as well as with Al-Qaeda. But that said, you're right, this is much more of a U.S. target. In general, the hunt for Al-Qaeda has been a U.S. operation, with Israel playing a very limited role, simply because Al-Qaeda hasn't been much of a menace to Israel. Israel has bigger problems with groups like Hamas, and so its own priorities are elsewhere. But you mentioned Syria, and that's a good example, where Israel invested pretty heavily in developing an operational capacity and an intelligence capacity far from its border in order to go after, and both in monitoring sense, but also in a targeting sense, to go after ISIS and Al-Qaeda figures. And that was very much to show its value to the United States. There's extensive U.S. intelligence cooperation with Israel on a range of issues, including counterterrorism. And Israel very much wants to show that it is a good partner. It gets a lot out of this relationship, and it's important for Israel's equities with Iran and equities in the region. So Israel developed its abilities in part for its own interests, but also in part to be able to do favors for the United States that would show its value. And Israel has done this sort of thing in the past. If you want to go way back to the Cold War, we see instances where Israeli operatives gained valuable information on the Soviet Union, on Soviet military technology that in some cases were important to Israel, but were tremendously important to U.S. intelligence at the time.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about al-Masri. The name al-Masri, or the moniker al-Masri, means the Egyptian. I assume this is a guy who was part of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad substrate that actually really ran al-Qaeda underneath the Saudi figure at its top. Is that right?
So he was part of the Egyptian mafia, if you will, and what makes the Egyptians interesting and unusual is that some of them are figures like Ayman Zawahiri himself, who headed his own group, who very much had an organization, while others are individuals who flitted between different groups and were part of a broader movement, if you will. And al-Masri, unlike Zawahiri, really was involved in fighting the Soviets. So he was someone who had certainly, you know, was very much part of the Egyptian movements, but at the same time was also very much part of what al-Qaeda was trying to do, which was much more international and global than the regime-focused Egyptians in the early 1990s, late 1980s. So he's kind of a natural bridge figure between these. And we see a number of these folks who showed up in al-Qaeda's leadership at the time. Now, because many of these people have been killed, we've seen a transition in leadership where the Egyptian mafia is not nearly as important as it was 20 years ago, but he's a vestige of that time in al-Qaeda's history.
So I started the podcast with a joke about this being the most dangerous job in the world. And to be precise, I suppose the most dangerous job in the world was the number three in al-Qaeda for a long time, because you had bin Laden, you had Zawahiri, and then there were this string of number threes that the U.S. would claim to have killed or captured, right? And, you know, a lot of them were, you know, you'd read these news stories, well, the U.S. kills al-Qaeda's number three, and you kind of say, again? And it would be somebody that you've never heard of. And for me, this was another example of that, right? We kill the number two in al-Qaeda, and I'd never heard of the guy before. And I guess my question is, are these really a string of really important counterterrorism operations and kills? Or is this a situation where you get somebody and then you kind of leak to the New York Times, hey, it's somebody really important, we got somebody? Or is this like a systematic wiping out over time of their operational management?
I see it as a systematic campaign. This was someone who was tremendously important. So if we were having this discussion in the aftermath of 9/11, you know, he would certainly be, you know, near the top of the list of people the United States wanted to go after. I'm always a bit skeptical when the reports talk about al-Qaeda's number two, in part just because this individual was in Iran. He was kind of frozen out from a lot of what was going on in al-Qaeda. To me, his direct operational and leadership role is questionable, or was questionable. So should, and we'll probably discuss this, should Zawahiri actually be dead, would this guy have taken the helm from Iran is to me really a question mark. But that said, he clearly was a senior leader, and whether he was number two or you put him farther down is to me uncertain, but nevertheless, he mattered. And this is something, as your question indicated, the United States has been doing since 9/11. It's been trying to go after not just the bin Ladens, not just the people who plant bombs, but the senior recruiters, the senior trainers, the senior planners. And these are the people that gave al-Qaeda its depth, that made it such a dangerous organization. And I think one of the reasons that al-Qaeda has been far less effective in global operations, far less effective attacks on the U.S. and attacks on Europe, is because people like al-Masri have been killed or otherwise taken out of the game. And so this is part of the U.S. strategy, is to go after a fairly broad swath of these people. And it's been fairly effective in the relatively narrow terms we're talking about for counterterrorism.
Let's talk about al-Zawahiri. The rumor that Zawahiri is dead came from where, and how credible do you assess it as being at this point?
So some very serious journalists who have ties to, not ties to is the wrong word, who have connections with a range of jihadists and jihadist organizations are reporting that Zawahiri has not been in touch for a while, that people think he's dead. And these are serious people. And we've heard reports of this before, but the reports were much more short-lived in the past, and they tended to be linked to an attack. So, you know, this explosion happened, Zawahiri may have been killed. Oh, he wasn't, right? And this is simply a dropping off. This is something that is more sustained. But the caveat is that there's no definitive statement yet. And al-Qaeda usually acknowledges that its senior leadership has been killed. There's usually some sort of martyrdom announcement or some sort of effectively obituary. So that may come. But one thing that's been a big part of U.S. counterterrorism success has been diminishing the ability of the Zawahiris of the world and of al-Qaeda's leadership to communicate. So when the Zawahiri weighed in on the Arab Spring, when he weighed in on the UAE-Israel peace deal, he would do so weeks late. You know, it would be as if you had an announcement now that it looked like, you know, President Trump was starting to lose in the Electoral College, right? It would be kind of like, wait, where did that come from? Like, is this one, you know, 3 weeks late, 2 weeks late? And so they were very much out of touch. So it's possible that this is simply yet another disruption in communication, but it's looking pretty grim for the al-Qaeda leader. And so he very well may be dead. And the fact that he's not refuting this is, of course, a bad sign for him. If people can think you're dead for a long period of time, it doesn't say much about how you're managing the day-to-day of the global movement. So anyone who's worked in this space at all tends to be very cautious on this because we've heard these reports and they've been wrong. But this is a very serious report.
And what are the specifics of the report? My understanding is that it is that he died of natural causes, not in an attack. Is that right?
That's what I've heard as well. And one would think the United States or whoever did it would want to claim credit if there was an attack. So they would be, you would have information from government and so on saying he may be killed, we're checking it out. You would expect the agencies and bureaucracies to want the credit for it. So it does seem to be of natural causes, but there's just, again, a lot we don't know.
It's pretty hard to imagine that if the United States got him, the president would be able to keep it to himself.
That's not his strong point, right? So I think we can safely say that, you know, keeping intelligence secure and recognizing nuance and ambiguity are not, you know, strong points of President Trump. And so my guess is if there were a report that was deemed credible, he would be boasting about it on Twitter.
So at this stage, al-Qaeda has lost at least a former senior operational figure, although somebody who may or may not have been playing any significant role today. It may have lost its actual post-Bin Laden leader and somebody who was the, you know, managerial leadership of the organization from very early on, and or at least from the time of the merger. And, you know, it's been a long time since al-Qaeda has pulled off any kind of any of its sort of signature spectacular attacks. It's been largely upstaged by ISIS in recent years. How unhealthy is the organization at this point?
There are debates on this. I tend to be, I'm going to say, the optimistic side in that I think al-Qaeda has been hit very hard. So we tend to divide al-Qaeda into, you know, at least two categories. One is the al-Qaeda core, the relatively small group of people that are around the leaders like bin Laden in the past, or Zawahiri, based in Pakistan, often fighting in Afghanistan. And then there are the affiliates. So al-Qaeda's groups in Yemen, in North Africa, in the Indian subcontinent. And the al-Qaeda core is fighting Afghanistan. It's maintained ties to the Taliban under a lot of pressure, so there are some successes there. But it hasn't launched a significant attack on the United States and Europe in many years. And that's a huge shift for an organization that declared the United States the number one enemy, that made those attacks its brand. So that's something that's a big success of counterterrorism and shows weakness. However, the group has affiliates that are quite strong. And depending on where you look in the world, the strength is different. But a couple things on the affiliates. One, they are mostly about their country and region. So the North African affiliate tends to focus on North Africa. And this has implications for U.S. interests in North Africa, but it's not the same as a direct threat to the U.S. homeland. But we do see some of these affiliates reaching out beyond their area of operation. So we see al-Qaeda's branch in the Arabian Peninsula based in Yemen that had ties to several attacks in Europe. We also in 2019 saw an individual that at the very least was inspired, but had some degree of connection to the Yemen branch, a Saudi trainee who was at a military base in Florida who killed several Americans there. So we do see the affiliates doing some attacks. The important qualification, though, is the scale and scope of these is far less than many people would feared years ago. So I think if you go back to some of the very dire predictions in the early 2000s, where people are saying we're going to see lots of spectacular attacks, we're going to see a steady pace, that didn't happen. So we do see occasional attacks. We do see some degree of inspiration. We see Al-Qaeda figures that whose propaganda matters. But all that said, the organization is far weaker than it was 15 years ago.
I want to suggest that the organization may even be significantly weaker than it was 5 years ago. So Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was the most active affiliate in exporting terrorist activity, but that seems to have been largely a result of Anwar al-Awlaki and this one particularly energetic bomb maker and the group of people around him. And, you know, the other affiliates, with the solitary exception of ISIS, which of course is now a sort of competitive franchise, are not really in the business of, as you point out, they're not really in the business of terrorism beyond the shores of their local conflict. And so I guess my question is, at this stage, are these really meaningfully Al-Qaeda affiliates anymore? Or is this more like, you know, we used to have an international, you know, the international socialist movement, and they were all kind of part of one giant international movement. They were local affiliates. Now you just have kind of left parties all over the world, right? And they don't have any great meaningful connections with one another. You know, we used to have Al-Qaeda Corps and its affiliates, and now you just kind of have a bunch of like local, like fundamentalist terrorist organizations. Are they even meaningfully Al-Qaeda anymore in any serious sense?
This tension has been there for a while. If you go back to some of the documents that U.S. forces captured when they killed bin Laden in Abbottabad in 2011, a lot of the back and forth at the time is about these affiliates, that they never listen, that we're trying to get them to do different kinds of targeting, but they don't pay attention to us. There is constant complaining. So what we did see, though, is a couple shifts that mattered, but not as much as Al-Qaeda, the core, would have liked. So one was that the groups became more regional. So they tended to, in the past, to be very focused on one particular country. So the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb was, we talked about it really being about Algeria, right? But it becomes much more about North Africa, going after targets in a wide range of countries there. And we see this pattern again and again, where groups shift from local to at least a bit more regional. They also tend to be a bit more international in their targeting in their region. So they begin to go after, say, UN facilities or US embassies more than they would have in the past. So there are shifts. And then, as you say, the big exception or unusual one to all this is the Yemen branch. And part of this is Al-Awlaki. You have arguably the most effective English language propagandist in the jihadist world is for a long time based out of Yemen until the US kills him. And so he is someone who is inspiring people. And even today, you'll still see attacks in the West happen where this person will have listened to Al-Awlaki's sermons, that he's someone whose words endure beyond the grave. But we also, even after his death, we did see Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula at least tied to individuals who were active in the United States and Europe. So it didn't go away completely with Al-Awlaki, but Al-Awlaki himself was an exceptionally dangerous individual because of his power to persuade.
All right. So in the United States, we have a presidential transition that is not yet going on, but will be going on soon if Al-Qaeda has really lost both its number one and number two. it needs to have a transition as well. And so to all the people out there who want to get their resumes in front of, you know, the transition team for Al-Qaeda, who's going to be choosing the new Ayman al-Zawahiri? You know, what's the structure like for the creation of a new leadership? When bin Laden was killed, it was kind of obvious that Zawahiri takes over. Who takes over now if he is in fact dead? And perhaps most importantly, who do people send their resumes to in the Al-Qaeda transition team?
So this is a great question, and I like how you phrased it. I don't know who's going to take over, right? And even before the killing of al-Masri, I wouldn't have known, because to me, the leadership is scattered, and there are different factions, and it's really an open question of who could do this. Al-Qaeda itself is a very bureaucratized organization, and I actually mean that as a compliment. It's an organization that had lots of committees and invested very seriously in institutional development. They have leadership committees who will determine who the emir is. And in addition, I would be surprised if they didn't have a succession plan. It can't have been a surprise that the surprise to me is actually that Zawahiri lived as long as he did, not that he died. So the idea of having someone in waiting is quite plausible to me. But you raise a key question, right? Which is, who is this person going to be? And this person may have some credibility in that they have a lot of veterans of different jihads, so they're likely to find someone who is respected as a fighter. But will this person have the stature, I think, of bin Laden is unrealistic, but even of someone lesser like Zawahiri? And that's unlikely. And because this movement is already regionalized, because it's spread among so many different countries, there'll be a question of what its priorities should be. There'll be different people who, if not vying for leadership themselves, will at least be asking themselves, how much do I need to pay attention to this new guy? And here, U.S. counterterrorism becomes very important. For any leader to consolidate his position, they're going to need to communicate. They're going to need to be rallying people to their side. They're going to need to be ensuring that resources can flow to the extent that they have any resources. And they're going to need to make sure they can assert their authority. But all that requires meeting people, talking on the phone, all these things that are exceptionally dangerous when there are drones flying overhead and people are hunting you. So there is a possibility that they'll choose a leader, and that leader may be killed quickly, or that leader will be unable to consolidate power because they can't communicate effectively.
So while Al-Qaeda has deteriorated, there is this counterpoint organization that has flourished, and that is Hezbollah. And I think the contrast between them is really interesting, that Hezbollah is under constant pressure as Al-Qaeda is under constant pressure, yet it has basically, to a large degree, managed to hold captive the entire Lebanese state. What are the things that Hezbollah has done right that Al-Qaeda has done wrong?
It's a pretty long list. So with Hezbollah, let me highlight a few things. One is that they began with part of their mission being something that was relatively popular in Lebanon, which was expelling Israeli forces from Lebanon. And they gained a lot of credibility, both because that mission was popular, but also because in the end they won. So Hezbollah is the only Arab military force that has beaten Israel through force of arms. And it gained a lot of credibility because of its struggle, and it gained a lot of credibility because it won. Now, it squandered a lot of that fighting in Syria and had a lot of problems, but it started with a strong base. In addition, Hezbollah is a very active political player in Lebanon, and it has constituencies, it has a range of political outreach. So it's very in touch with Lebanese political opinion, the political opinion of the Lebanese Shia community. And it's often actually quite careful in what it does as a result. So Hezbollah does attack Israel, but it also doesn't attack Israel. So we haven't seen a major Israel-Hezbollah clash since 2006, and that's a very long time. People were very nervous that we'd see a recurrence of this war. And both sides have been cautious, even as they've been aggressive. And that's because Hezbollah doesn't want lots of Israeli bombs raining down on Lebanon, because it'll hurt opinion of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And also, Hezbollah does social services. So it does hospitals, it does schools. It tries to win over the population and not just the Shia population. And so with all that, it has a degree of public support, it has a degree of stature, and also it has a degree of coercion. That Hezbollah has shown that it will kill people in Lebanon. Hezbollah has shown that it will suppress rivals. And so it's maintaining its monopoly over the Shia community in particular, but also to some degree Lebanon, through a mixture of what it's able to accomplish, but also what it's able to threaten. And all that is very pragmatic. And that's the opposite of groups like Al-Qaeda, groups like the Islamic State, where they're hoping that the dramatic terrorist attack, the dramatic military victory will inspire success. But Hezbollah recognized that the slow, difficult work of politics and social services, which require a lot of compromise, that that's actually gives you a much more solid foundation. And the last thing to add, of course, is state support. Hezbollah has benefited tremendously from the support of Syria, but especially of Iran. And that's been in the form of military training and weapons, but also huge amounts of money. And that has enabled Hezbollah to maintain very strong social services. It's enabled Hezbollah to have a very formidable military. And so having that mix of domestic and state support has made Hezbollah very powerful.
So I'm going to bring the Hezbollah side of this around to the Al-Qaeda side. And of course, the link is that this guy al-Masri is killed in Iran, which is Hezbollah's principal backer. So my question is, given that Iran has a historically pretty fraught relationship with Al-Qaeda, and that they're on the opposite sides of a bunch of conflicts, including in Syria, what on earth was this senior Al-Qaeda figure doing hiding out in Iran?
So Iran has a pragmatic, if somewhat hateful, relationship with different parts of the Sunni jihadist movement. So even before 9/11, we saw Iran was a transit route for people to go train with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, they talk about fighters going back and forth to Iran who were part of the 9/11 plot. And Iran wasn't the haven and the supporter that Pakistan was for the jihadist movement, but it was nevertheless there. Even as at this time, Iran almost went to war with the Taliban in 1998. Now, after 9/11, after Al-Qaeda is rousted from Afghanistan, a significant branch of the organization goes to Iran. And you see figures like al-Masri, you see another key leader, Saif al-Adel, you see Zarqawi, who becomes the key figure in Iraq, he transits Iran. So you have this connection. And from the Iranian point of view, there are several advantages. One is that by maintaining connections with this organization, you can limit the threat to Iran itself, that it's a way of trying to co-opt them and reduce the direct danger to Iran. Also, you can try to direct them against your own enemies, which is what the Iranians do by enabling them to transit Iran and go to Iraq to fight U.S. forces, where they become devastatingly effective and really cause problems in Iraq itself, even though at times they're going after a lot of Iranian-backed figures there as well. They're also a bargaining chip. So in the early 2000s, there was a question on whether the United States would give up its support, or at least tacit protection, of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which is an anti-Iran terrorist group, and whether the United States would give that up in exchange for Iran giving up all these Al-Qaeda figures. And that deal was very much a possibility. So you had all these very pragmatic sorts of connections, and they both, Al-Qaeda and Iran, had some common enemies. There were, whether it was Saudi Arabia or the Egyptian government or the United States, there were reasons for cooperation. But that said, the Iranians were often very restrictive. And we have a lot of reports from internal al-Qaeda correspondence that was later released where they're complaining about the Iranians, they're complaining about the treatment of their people. There's a kidnapping of an Iranian diplomat where they're trying to trade for some of the al-Qaeda people. So Iran is offering, if you will, protection, but it's a very restrictive protection, and it's not the kind of protection al-Qaeda wants. The last thing I'll say on this, though, is that the Iranian protection, for the most part, has been very effective. The United States is working with allies around the world to arrest al-Qaeda figures. At times, it is using drones to go after al-Qaeda figures to kill them. And the one place they've had some degree of sanctuary from this has been Iran. Now, with this reported killing that Israel did, that sanctuary at least is diminished. But compared to other countries, compared to Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Iran has been a relative sanctuary. So despite the many problems this has caused al-Qaeda, it's been beneficial, and that's probably why they're willing to continue it, despite the reputational costs. Iran is loathed within the broader Sunni jihadist movement, and in fact, the Islamic State used to beat up al-Qaeda on this issue. They used to point out their connections and say that it showed that they were traitors to Islam, but al-Qaeda kept these connections, I think, just because of the benefits of having even a restricted sanctuary.
We're going to leave it there. Dan Byman, thanks so much for joining us. When you get the call from the al-Qaeda transition team, I hope you will return and give us a briefing on their plans.
I got to revise my resume first, but will do.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Ian Enright of the firm Goat Rodeo. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. So tweet about us, share us on Facebook, upvote us on Reddit, make TikTok videos about us if you've downloaded TikTok, which you should not do. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our merch is available at thelawfarestore.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.